Welcome to Behind the Curtain, Nashville's Movers, Shakers,
and Tastemakers,
brought to you by Cord Real Estate, your key to the heart of Nashville. I'm Steve Luther alongside my co-host, Van Hoy.
Here we peel back the layers of Nashville's vibrant scene, sitting down with the innovators, creators, and leaders who shape our city. From music to business and everything in between, we dive into the journeys that have brought them to where they are today.
We're here to uncover the stories behind the success, the passion driving their pursuits, and why they've chosen Nashville as their stage. It's about the people who dream big, push boundaries, and make this city truly unique.
So join us as we explore the heart and soul of Nashville through the eyes of those who know it best.
Well, today we're excited to have Ben Straup on the show. Ben is the president of Velocity Strategy Solutions, a company dedicated to empowering organizations through strategic growth, simplifying technology, and driving revenue. With a forward-thinking approach that focuses on data to overcome barriers and achieve remarkable outcomes, Ben's expertise in digital transformation, change management, and revenue operations has revolutionized how organizations succeed. An accomplished author and speaker, Ben is passionate about guiding teams to unlock their potential and achieve sustainable growth. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That all sounds impressive.
Well, thank
change
you.
Management.
Very impressive.
I love it.
So just to get started, why don't you share the story of founding Velocity and kind of what's the core mission of the company?
Absolutely. So for two decades, I sat second chair to some really amazing leaders who led some, you know, pretty dramatic changes within those organizations. And one of the things I learned is that the senior leader needs someone who can sit and work alongside them to see across the organization and enable that change to take place. And not just achieve a one-time event, but something that really is able to be sustained throughout the organization. And so as I kind of got to a point in the career, I realized that there was something of value there and that change happening outside of organizations was happening faster than those inside the organization could understand or even assimilate. And oftentimes organizations are built to insulate the person at the top from the opportunities that are in the marketplace. And as a result of that, the person with the most decision making authority, the person with access to budget, often is the last person to really be aware of what those changes are. And so I really wanted to take what I had done for, you know, nearly two decades and enable all leaders in organizations who wanted to see breakthrough change take place, figure out how to make that true, and kind of stand in the gap between internal and external stakeholders to bring about that change into existence. And having tried and failed at that a number of times, one of the things I learned was that if you hire an agency, they're really good at doing the things that they're good at. If you hire a consultant, they're really good at telling you ideas and maybe even building and shaping the architecture of things. But what a leader really needs is someone who's willing to kind of roll up the sleeves once the planning work is done and actually lead the organization through the implementation and adoption of that. And so the heartbeat of Velocity is to be kind of an extension of that leadership group to enable the change that they see so clearly. And we do that by pairing operations to strategy.
Now, a big part of your work emphasizes the importance of simplifying technology and aligning teams. What are some of the common challenges you see organizations face in these areas, and what kinds of things can you do to help overcome those?
So we have four parts of an organization that we coordinate in order to enable the change to take place. People, process, technology, and data. The very first thing is we have to make sure that we have interdependent collaborative teams that are aligned around shared outcomes. This is a departure from kind of traditional industrial management that believes in kind of the division of labor, if you will. So we need to actually surround a challenge with a 360-degree view, and we need to empower that team to actually deliver that change that's possible. So you don't want just the you don't want just the sales team leading the change. You want sales and you want operations and finance and all the different parts of the organization to do that. So once we have that group aligned with the makeup necessary in order to lead the change, then we have to decide how we're going to work together, both within the team and how that team relates to the rest of the organization. And there's all kinds of, you know, specific terms around that, standard operating procedures and service line agreements and so on and so forth. I like to call them permission systems. And when we don't explore those and explicitly discuss those, then we tend to default back to current reality and known behaviors, behaviors that are often inherited by watching others that we've seen in the organization. And if you're trying to change, you are in essence trying to do something that's never done before. So you need to actually think about what you're doing and how that affects others. Once we have that, then we institutionalize the way that that team wants to work with technology. And I think the problem is that too many times organizations look at technology as the solution, and then they try to map how they work around the technology instead of deciding how they want to work and then finding the technology to be able to actually achieve that and enable that to be true. And then the last part of it, if we do those first three really well, then we have designed a capture and a collection system for data that allows it to be stored in structured and unstructured environments, which then allows us to capture insight and value from that, which we can play back to the team in role-specific areas so that they are seeing relevant real-time data as they're moving through the change that influences day-to-day activity, and they can see long-term trend data that gives them confidence that the change that they're seeking to make is actually possible and that they're making progress.
So do you have issues with buy-in on this? Like, so when there's a primary leader, does that person bring you in, or is it somebody on part of the team? It's like, hey, we need this, and they have to sell it up the chain.
So we almost exclusively are brought in by those at the leadership group. So I would say, depending on the size of the organization, you know, director, vice president level and up, many times is directly with the C-suite. And these are individuals who have very qualified, capable team members inside their executive team. But for whatever reason, they've tried and they have not succeeded at doing this. And a lot of times it's because the methods that we are bringing to the table are not yet kind of normal operating procedures for how those teams get done. CEO walks in, says, I want this change, hands it off to the technology person. And what happens? It becomes a technology problem. Mm-hmm. CEO says, I want this data, hand off to the BI person. It becomes a business intelligence problem. And instead of, we have to actually all surround that opportunity, and we have to understand what do we know and what do we don't, and what don't we know? And then how do we expand and create meaning and value out of that?
So you stay integrated with all those different teams.
Absolutely. And the reason why we need to enter at the top of the organization is not because we're special. It's because that view.
I always like to think I'm special.
That view actually sees across the organization and is synthesizing the details of it. It also is the key stakeholder in possessing the decision-making authority and the access to budget to actually enable that change to take place.
Wow. Isn't that nice? Back when I was in the music, you know, somebody would want to, you know, you want to sign a band at a label, the president of the label, like, okay, we're signing this band. Everybody jump on board. No, you'd have to do a, you know, the label head might like you, or the head of A&R might like you, or somebody's into you. Then they do a showcase, and you'd have to like bring in marketing and sales and PR. You had to bring in all the different elements, and you had to sell them all on the band, not just the head guy or gal. So isn't that nice? Just getting to make a decision and everybody jumps in.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious.
I'm not sure it's that simple, but it certainly requires executive level buy-in to achieve systemic change.
That's good.
I'm kind of curious what types of organizations you typically work with, because a lot of this seems very corporate, and like for us, we have the interesting wrinkle of, you know, most real estate agents, the way it works is they're independent contractors.
Right.
And so trying to force them to use any particular systems or things like that can be very, very difficult. Do you work with organizations that have sort of different structures like that? And are you able to get buy-in somehow? And how does that work?
Because do you only work with major corporations?
I'd love some free advice while we're here.
Yeah, there you go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course we do. And, you know, when you look at, we work with organizations of all sizes, and we are what we call industry agnostic. Mm. The problem of trying to build what we call the growth architecture to support and sustain the change is something that's true inside every organization. It just looks different at different stages. Right. And the good news is once you figure it out, it probably needs to be broken and rebuilt anyway. That's the elasticity and agility that's required in today's world. But one character or one type of organization that we've worked a lot with in the financial services or the consulting space, professional services, often have decentralized networks of individuals that are out in the field. They all, you know, whether it's a law firm, accounting firm, real estate firm, it's all the same thing. And you know, really, truly, you know, there is resistance across all of those. We always default to what's most comfortable for us. Mm. And what we find, particularly in those types of organizations, and I would imagine you'd find this as well, is that they tend to be what we call results-oriented individuals, which right. means that they're going to continue current course and speed until they determine that a new idea is good or better and will net them good or better results than what they're getting right now. And so it's not necessarily resistance. We just haven't done the work necessary to be able to help them observe the friction and the flow within their own business. And then how do we invite them in to explore the possibilities of what that might look like?
I like that. Invite them in to explore. We're going to use that.
It really does. I mean, you know, gosh, I remember when I was early on in my career in a sales rep, I mean, the last thing I wanted to do at 11:30 at night while I was catching a flight that wasn't going to land until 1:30 in the morning was hammer out in Salesforce, you know, what the conversation was
right.
with prospect, right? But I think there are ways to reduce the friction. And I think there are ways to help people realize that they're going to win more. And if we can reduce the friction and increase the flow and show them how that can happen, that can be a really beneficial. The other thing that I find in those organizations is that oftentimes the feedback loops don't go back up, they just come down. Mm. We need you to do this, right? And so there really isn't an opportunity. And with the counterbalance of 1099s and the increased number of 1099s that are mixed in with W-2s, it really does change, there's this phrase, permission systems within an organization. Right. Mm-hmm. So we do have to invite them in. We do have to give them an opportunity to consider that new reality and determine if it is a preferred one. And so we want those feedback loops from coming up and down. And that's a key part of what we do around stakeholder alignment.
I feel like I need to be taking notes, feedback loops and friction and flow. This is good stuff. No wonder he's wearing the suit and tie.
Yeah. Now you're an author as well.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about some of what you've written. You know, maybe what's one or two of the key concepts that you think are important for leaders today?
I think the first and foremost, when it comes to what's important for leaders, it's just fundamental curiosity. Mm. They need to realize that we're living in a time where we have it's a very interesting mix of expectations. We probably haven't seen this broad of a mix since maybe moving from the agrarian to the industrial economy. But if you think about it, in most organizations, your senior leaders are still part of that that world where this is how you work. You went to an office at a certain time, you went right. home at a certain time. You know, the company purchased, there was no bring your own device. You abided by the company policy, right? Or you deferred to the good of the company, not necessarily the individual. And then you've got the leaders just behind them, and they kind of lived through a transition where you see the Jack Welch generation kind of waning over time, and you're seeing kind of a more, you know, this employee engagement and awareness that has come into play. And then you see kind of the new managers that are out there, and they feel very empowered by kind of the self-directed learning, but they're still participating inside kind of a corporate setting and believe that that type of environment is something that's going to help them thrive. And so they want meaning and significance, and they see that by doing it with others in a particular way. And then you have those that are graduating college now coming in who don't remember a time that when they wanted to do something, they couldn't find a video on YouTube and then
right.
didn't do it.
Right.
And so the idea that we have still established norms around how you progress through organizations and when you're qualified to do certain things. And so I think what's most important is that leaders have to realize that the way people are getting information, the way they're making decisions, how that disrupts power structures and decision-making authority is dramatic, and it's changing in real time. And so if you don't if you're not curious about the world and how it's changing, you're going to be left behind. And I think that the second thing is the fact that leaders have to be flexible. You know, when COVID hit, we thought we had most things figured out.
Right.
I mean, if you can imagine in January of that year, we thought that we were, you know, impervious to any obstacle, right? It was just a raging machine of growth. And then 10 weeks later, we're wondering if the grocery stores are going to be restocked and we're going to have enough water.
Or toilet paper. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Order the bidet.
That's right. And everything had to be remapped. You know, organizations faced, you know, whether they wanted to or not, faced how do I resource a remote distributed team? And what that exposed, that anxiety came from untested and underdeveloped strategies around what it looks like when we don't all come to the same office, which is really a relic of a different era, you know, especially in the knowledge-based economy.
Crazy.
And so if you don't have that curiosity and you don't have that agility, you will not survive this persistent rate of change that we're existing in. Mm. So we went from things were incrementally changing to I can't trust trend lines pre-COVID because those assumptions and those realities are no longer true. I do not yet have enough data to be able to give trend lines going forward. So I have to fall in love with the process and the evolution. And technology is teaching us, forcing us to do that, right? The introduction of generative AI and how that is just remapping things. There's so much coming at us so fast that if we're not curious and we're not flexible, we're going to break.
Let's talk a little bit about your podcast. So you've got a podcast as well. What's what kind of inspired you to start the podcast? What are you hoping to achieve with it? What's it about and where can they find it?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find it on all major platforms. It's called The Velocity Factor. We also have a blog on thevelocityfactor.com to kind of follow along with it. I mean, really, truly, what gets me up every morning is that I know there's a leader out there that sees absolute with clarity what they want to achieve. And they're presently unable to make progress in that area. And so I want them to know that there's at least one person taking a stand for them, that in the hard decisions and in the lonely times and in the closed door office meetings. And when those moments come, that there is a process and a pathway for discovering and bringing along their organization, and that there is a future and a possibility for them to be able to achieve that. And I want them to know there's at least one person out there that understands what it means to sit in that role and to have to kind of live in the balance between now and next.
What put that fire in you?
I think working with these leaders in the last couple of decades who just, you know, who do you go to when you have to remake your leadership team? You sit the vice presidents down and tell them, guys, we're going to have to remake this. Who do you go to when you realize that you've got to restack the board because, you know, there's too much resistance to the change that you know is going to be required in the marketplace? You sit the board down and say, okay, we're going to have to remake you guys now. We're going to press pause and do, you know, fruit basket turnover. You can't do that. So there's very few safe places for leaders in the midst of change. And then we have these unrealistic expectations that when we ask leaders to do new things, they're going to get predictable results, which is just a threshold of expectation, which is ridiculous. And so how do we provide enough cover so that you can work through the hard parts of change management and stakeholder alignment and in enrolling people into the possibilities of what's possible? How do we aid them and do that in a systematic way so that not only do you make the change and achieve a one-time peak experience, but that becomes a new reality for that leader. And so I wake up every day going, who is out there that feels completely alone? And how can I give them at least knowledge and awareness that there's one person out there that is ready and willing to inspire them, whether that's through writing or podcast conversations or blog posts or speaking engagements that just says, hey, it's possible. Whatever you see in your head, it's possible. And there are ways to get there.
That's good. What are your dinner conversations like with your family at night?
Well, I tell people I've got an opinion on everything, whether I know anything about it or not.
Oh, I know somebody like that. I know somebody just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can tell you that most of the time my kids tell me, 17 and 13, that they don't always like to tell me things because I ask too many questions. And they just want to tell a story.
Right.
So usually the conversation goes with some observation and then somebody will say something and then I'll just flat out turn into curious.
You'll go.
And I'll just ask a million questions, trying to understand where that person's coming from and then engage with it.
You know? Yeah. Our kids hate that too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. They'll miss it someday. Yeah, they'll miss it.
So you talked about, okay, a management team gets together and realizes we got to make a change. One of the things you talk about is objective, unbiased perspective and how that's crucial for evaluating situations. Give an example of that, kind of how that, you know, what that looks like and how that impacts strategy.
So there's two sources of that. A lot of times in particularly in more mature organizations, the tenure of the leadership team, tells me how long it's been since the maturity of the ideas that are being colored by things that are happening outside the organization versus in the organization. Mm. So when I'm working with a leadership team in the average 10 years, 20 years, that represents somebody who's been inside the organization long enough to not have early or more recent experience with what's actually happening in the marketplace.
Right.
And so you start to see drift that comes out like, well, nobody really understands what we do, or nobody does what we do but us, or this has always worked. And they start to limit what their learning capacity is because they don't think anybody else can teach them anything. Mm. The second thing that comes from that is confirmation bias, which is really informed by their own past experience within the organization and their own success. And the truth of the matter is, what has made people successful in the past isn't necessarily what's going to make the organization successful moving forward, right? This is the chief revenue officer that says, you know, back in my day when we needed to raise revenue, we just pulled out the books from the, you know, local chamber of commerce and the book of lists, and we started calling,
right?
And we just made enough cold calls that we found buyers, and that's how we did it.
Teaching old dogs new tricks.
Yeah, and everyone in the room just kind of goes, okay.
Yeah.
No, you know, thank you very much. And moves on. And so, you know, I think what we try to do is we try to clarify what people are saying,
right?
Challenge by bringing kind of a different perspective to test it, to get it really withstand what needs to be, the problem. And then most important, can we all agree what the problem is? Right. And if we can all agree what the problem is, can we all agree the source of the problem? And if we can all agree on the source, can we all agree on the possibilities, or at least participate in shaping those possibilities? And then how do we prioritize them and decide to do that? We call that anywhere from same page conversations to just decision support. But many times we talk around opportunities and problems. We don't talk with each other about them. And so we have kind of a 2-day process that we go through. And the first, you'll appreciate this so affectionately, this is not the technical term, but I call it passion vomit, because it is when everybody on the team gets
very
to just,
descriptive.
Just get out of their system everything that they've been thinking.
Right.
And what we find is it's often the first time everyone that they work with has heard that.
That's good.
And so when we give space for everyone to say that, and we give space for everyone to hear that and to acknowledge that, it creates a shared understanding. Mm. And then you start to realize that if you all almost always agree on the problem, we just don't agree on the perspective. And that's often colored by either lack of being outside the organization, awareness of how changes have happened, or I've just been so successful that I can't help but only see it through the lens of my past success.
That's got to be an exciting process.
Oh my gosh, it's so invigorating.
Yeah.
I mean, it is absolute. I mean, like, it is just electrifying for me.
See, my title here is Chief Experience Officer, you see. So I would like want to hand out like custom air sickness bags with our logo on it, you know, when you do that and that whole exercise, you know, okay, here we're going to do, our passion vomit. Is that what it, passion, right?
Yeah.
Sure. That's it. You know, we're going to pass those out. Okay. Here, we're going to put this,
it's like
write it down and stick it in, you know?
Absolutely.
I love it.
Yeah. No, that's a great idea. I might actually.
Please.
Love that. That's fantastic. Thank you very much.
I like to say it's fantastic. You know, what can I say?
Nice.
So another concept you talk about is digital transformation. That's kind of a buzzword in a lot of industries. From your viewpoint, what does a successful digital transformation look like, and what are kind of the key elements of success?
Absolutely. So
using those buzzwords,
it means so many different things. I kind of look at digital transformation, the way we use that word today, kind of like how we use social media as a phrase back in 2004, 2005,
right?
Howard Dean had just introduced the world to blogging, and everyone had a blog.
That's right.
And we completely misused the terms. We didn't know what it was. We called a blog post a blog, you know.
Hey, Disney even had the dog with a blog, you know. Come on.
We called Twitter tweeter, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's just complete, you know, there's an overuse and a lack of shared understanding. And it's because it's new, right? Because everyone's trying to lay claim to what that is. But I think digital transformation is pretty straightforward. It is, how can we be more efficient and effective at what we're doing, right? And those two things have to be in balance, right? It's level of effort and rate of completion. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things that drive momentum, or as we like to say, velocity.
I was hoping you were going to say it. I was just sitting here hoping he would say that.
And so, you know, you have to understand, how can technology help us achieve things? And, you know, if we're still passing files around and getting human signatures around the office, like, that can be done a better way.
Isn't it nice and just heartwarming to, you know, just physically sign and read and touch?
I'm
sitting here alone, people. I'm all alone.
I'm a scan it and shred it kind of guy.
That's these guys too.
There's no doubt. I want to be able to access anything, anywhere, anytime, any place. That means it's got to be
a good company here.
Phone is my office.
That's right. That's really the efficiency part, but the effectiveness is, what feedback can it give us about, again, that idea of friction and flow that can help us identify maybe things that we couldn't see, or maybe we only could intuitively feel, or gives us a much more holistic perspective of what that experience is for everyone across the board. And then that allows us to be responsive to it. So it's almost like getting a superpower to managers,
right?
Because it finally says, okay, if I'm not getting enough action in the speed, then that probably is the result of ambiguity or complexity. So how do I get rid of that? And if you solve it one time, it's likely going to need to be solved again. So how do we then create institutional memory so that we understand that? And so the more that the more inputs that we can create efficiency, and the more outputs that we can display back, it gives us a sense of like walking through the business world with the dashboard of our car. You know, just because it was like, you know, in teaching my oldest to drive, you know, just because it says 40 miles an hour, if the person in front of you is going 30, you have to adjust.
Right.
You don't get to go 40 just because it's, you know, legal. You're constantly course correcting. You're constantly adjusting to a number of things. And I think digital transformation is enabling people to be successful with the least amount of friction, the maximum amount of effort on their part being put to the things that are really skilled type work. Where it's judgment calls, or it's making the key decisions that are going to make a dramatic difference on the bottom line and in the overall just success and growth of the organization.
And do what they do best.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the misnomer is digital transformation is about technology. That's not it at all. It's about reimagining how people work.
That's good.
So it seems like there's so much data collected nowadays, just a ridiculous amount of data. How do you see the role of data driving strategic decisions, operational efficiency? Maybe more importantly, how do you see data governance evolving? And what advice do you have for organizations to effectively manage and utilize all this data?
Yeah, and we are in the data world. I kind of liken it to turning 21. And we finally don't have to have the fake ID or know the bouncer at the back to get us into the bar.
Not that any of us ever did that.
No, not at all. Not at all. Nope. I think the statute of limitations is beyond that. but we have all of it, and you know, just like we did at that point in our lives, we did it because we could, and no one was going to tell us no. And so we've got all of this collection of data, but we haven't thought about how do we create meaning from it. And that's because of a couple of things. One, it's new. But the other thing is we haven't invited everybody to the table to create meaning out of it. And so we have to now that we've got all of it, we've got to figure out what to do with it. How do we create, how do we use this material good, if you will, and use that to build things and make better decisions? And how do we empower that to actually extract the value from it? And that happens in structured and unstructured ways. And so we have to have that conversation. And data governance is huge. And data governance in the past, because it's typically, you know, the strategic mind that comes in and says, we need to figure out how to use data. Now, that's a technology problem, right? Well, the technologist is always going to interpret data from a technology perspective, just like strategy is always going to interpret technology from a strategic perspective. The problem is you need those two characters. You actually need have this whole theory around the four minds. You need strategy, operations, technology, and data, all those together, working together in order to extract value out of digital transformation. And so once you figure out what you want to find, how do we get it in a trustworthy and repeatable way? And then how do we access it? And then once we eliminate the access point, like who needs to see what, when, and why, now becomes the hard part. See, the technology and the data part is actually very solvable. We may have to mature some of our processes. We have to think through some things, but that's solvable. The other problem we have is a human problem. We've been taught to orient ourselves toward data in what's often called a descriptive or reporting format. So we're always looking at what's already happened, right? So give me a great chart around the fact that we missed our number last quarter so I can show the board and explain to them why we're not going to do that again. Mm. Well, what we have yet to realize is there's two other accelerators in that I think are really important. Prescriptive, what's happening right now that could change my decision today. And so there goes into that curiosity and that flexibility. So if all I'm focused on is just perfecting what I already know and what I already know how to do, I'm not going to be open to the fact that actually what I thought was going to happen is not it at all. So I need to adjust and adapt. And then you can move to prescriptive or predictive data, which allows us to look forward. So if we have a broad enough data set, we can do modeling and we can say what's likely to happen based on certain scenarios. And so until we start demanding around the leadership table that decisions, proposals, recommendations are supported by data that's accessible, repeatable, and trustworthy, we will not truly extract the full value out of data.
Hmm. So along those lines, you mentioned AI. Maybe it's AI, maybe it's distributed computing, distributed data storage. What are some of the trends you see kind of coming down the pike that will shape the future of strategy and operations, and what should organizations be doing to prepare for those coming challenges?
I think the next 5 years is going to be should be dedicated by all organizations to get ready for AI. Hmm. Just because you have Grammarly doesn't mean that you're an AI company.
Right.
Generative AI is still a very, very much in its infancy. And it's very much, there's still, you know, it's like Oz, the man behind the curtain.
Right.
There's still a lot of human effort to simulate automation. We haven't really understood we haven't even seen or even begun to understand the possibilities that a large language model could bring us.
I mean, it's in its infancy and it's scary good now.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I can't imagine
five years from now. And the applications are just very small, right? Yep. I mean, they're very, it's amazing how fast we've gone from hearing about ChatGPT
right.
to that becoming a strategic partner.
Right.
But I mean, some of the organizations we're working with, as they're organizing their data, they're also looking at, for instance, one's a professional service group, a strategy firm. They're going to create their own large language model around all of the reports and strategy efforts that they've ever done in the last 30 years. Mm. And so if you can think about the ability to test a report before they deliver it to a client against 30 years of institutional knowledge,
incredible,
colored by their own kind of position statements and the way they see the world, that is going to make sure that it's taking into account a volume of experience and knowledge that one individual would take a lifetime in order to see. They're seeing this in the medical field, right? Mm-hmm. You have one person that might look at film and they might see, this is what I diagnose it to be. But if you can feed it to a model who's seen, 300 million
right.
variants of yeah. that, what's the likelihood that they're going to be more accurate or at least more complete in that? And so I think if organizations in the next 5 years could really understand how they need to kind of simplify the system architecture so that they have a predictable and reasonable data flow, and then they can figure out how to manage the collection, storage, and usage of structured and unstructured data. So then extract that value out of the organization. They'll be ready to start to take advantage, because over the next 5 years, also the capacity to do things that are very specific to that organization related to data and artificial intelligence will become more available, become more consumer friendly. And so you're going to see a lot more low code, no code environments, which is going to enable small businesses to thrive. Right. I mean, I think this time that we're in right now is equivalent to, if not greater than, the whole e-commerce movement that really disrupted retail.
Right.
Where I no longer had to own inventory. I no longer had to own a warehouse. I no longer had to own a storefront. I could do it all, drop ship it, and not even have to carry $1 in, an inventory cost from one fiscal year to the next. I could do it just in time. Right. Mm-hmm. So here we are now. I mean, I think it's going to level the playing field. I think as technology gets more powerful, it's actually going to become more accessible. So the individuals, real estate agents, attorneys, doctors, everybody is going to have the ability to do something that's specific to their own data set, but then also specific to their industry as well. Mm. And I think it's going to change. I mean, I think about, in school learning about the card catalog.
Right.
And then we went from the card catalog that you could do these search databases online, and that would return that. And now you're going to be able to assimilate and synthesize information. Doesn't mean we don't have to validate it. Doesn't mean that we don't have to inspect it and make sure it stands, worthy of that. We should do that anyway with research. But it means that it's going to shorten the time to collect and organize that data, which means I'm going to have more time to spend making meaning out of it.
Right.
I oftentimes refer that to kind of rediscovering the wisdom tradition. Mm. You know, that perspective and knowledge is what equals wisdom. Mm-hmm. And we've been so focused on efficiency, and that's how we viewed technology. We viewed it as a byproduct of the industrial age, right? Division of labor, get scale as big as possible. Lean methodology is all about doing it again and again and again and removing the potential for errors and risk. Well, now we've got to shift that, and we've got to quit looking at technology simply as a way to scale the same thing over and over again. And we've got to look at it as a way to participate and co-create with us into a future that is ever evolving.
Wow.
Yeah. I do think it has the potential to be a big equalizer. And I think it's going to be a tremendous competitive advantage for the people that really get into it. I feel like for a lot of small businesses, it's probably overwhelming. I can't imagine. I've got some tech background, so I'm a little more comfortable with it than some. But even for me, like, the thought of developing applications around AI is a little bit daunting. If I wasn't here at Cord, I don't know that there would be as big of a push into AI as we've made.
Definitely not.
Where do you see that shaking out? Like, do you see this really becoming an equalizer, or do you see this as like, there's going to be people that jump on board and have a tremendous competitive advantage?
The elite.
There's going to be a lot of people that just kind of get shaken out because they didn't get on the boat.
But I think a lot of people didn't even like email at first. They wanted to, but they eventually came around. Fair. Good old AOL and whatnot.
That's right, man. We love those discs. Yeah, coming in the mail, right?
Absolutely.
I still remember going to CompuServe, right? And buying software out of a box.
It was exciting.
With a stack of diskettes, right?
And all the books and pictures.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the computer clubs and, where the reps would come and feature all the software that was coming out. And, new software came out once a year, or twice a year.
We get there eventually.
So,
us slow people.
I think there have always been people that have been slow to adopt, right? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. I mean, that whole law of diffusion of innovation, right?
Right.
There are certain people that, they can't use something today not because they don't want to, but because it simply doesn't exist.
That's why we surround ourselves with people like you, So people smarter, more plugged in.
Yeah, I think it's going to come. Certainly, the early adopters are going to be the pioneers. Pioneers always do two things: they take the most arrows, and they come up with the most discoveries. And then, as it starts to normalize, we'll see a greater adoption. And it becomes part of it. But I do think that
with greater velocity.
That's right. Absolutely, I love it. I feel like we should have a jar.
Absolutely. Oh, I like that. Yeah, let's do that.
Throw a dollar in. That's right. Those that go that are first will see some great advantages, and that'll inspire the rest. And then there will be some that just won't participate, and they'll go away. But there will also be new people that come in. What we forget is that this is new for us. But for those that are in the 10, 12, 15-year-old range, mm-hmm. this is going to be normal. For
right.
them.
It's all they already know. Yeah.
And so every generation has had to deal with that. I mean, my dad never trusted cloud drives.
Right.
He still believes, you know, the old zip disks were the best way to do it. You know, you downloaded everything and then you moved it to the next computer. it's going to naturally become part of what we do. I think about how long it took. I remember using DocuSign in 2010, 2011, right? Mm-hmm. I would frequently get calls from clients or prospects and say, my legal department says I can't sign this because it's digital. So what we did, right, is we faxed each other, we signed it, and then we faxed it back. That's somehow more trustworthy, right? The ink is so diluted, you can't even read the terms of the agreement.
Right. I used to love my fax machine. It's a little dot at the end. You know,
the early ones, right? They had the little plastic paper that had kind of like the film on it.
Yeah.
So and it would always like around the edges was dark black. And
that's right.
For sure. And then, of course, you know, somebody picked up the phone while it was in the midst.
Yes.
Then it broke.
It was over.
The dial up and you had to start all over again.
The good old day.
That's right.
It has been an absolute pleasure.
Are you saying it's over? Well, you're so rude. This is good.
If someone wants to reach out, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Ben Straup, Straup. You can check out velocitystrategysolutions.com. It's the website. If you're interested in the blog or the podcast, go to thevelocityfactor.com. And then if you're interested in just learning about me, benstraup.com.
Good stuff.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. Enjoyed having you, and we'll see you guys next time.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. It was a blast.
Well, that's a wrap on today's episode of Behind the Curtain, Nashville's Movers, Shakers,
and Tastemakers.
We hope you've been inspired by the stories of passion, perseverance, and innovation right here in Nashville.
A big thank you to our guests for sharing their journeys and to you, our listeners, for joining us. And of course, our gratitude to Accord Real Estate for making this conversation possible.
Don't forget to follow or subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.
Thank us.
Yes, you did.
Oh, I guess I did. Well, thank us. Okay.
Like I was saying.
Oh, yeah.
Don't forget to follow or subscribe on your favorite platform to catch every episode and hit that notification bell. We've got plenty more fascinating guests lined up, ready to share their insights and inspirations.
And we love hearing from you. So reach out to us with your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for who you'd like to hear from next.
Until next time, keep chasing your dreams and making your mark in Nashville.
Oh, my goodness. Remember, am I talking to Casey
it's
Kasem?
It's the people behind the scenes that make the city shine.
I love it. Take care. See you behind the curtain.